Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson from The Middle. I'm coming to the Palace Theater in Waterbury Monday, June 3rd for a national taping of my show. Former White House climate advisor Gina McCarthy and NBC Connecticut chief meteorologist Ryan Hanrahan will be there to talk about getting the politics out of climate change. Get your tickets at ctpublic.org/the middle.
Sponsored locally by Connecticut Green Bank, Eversource Energy, and the Governor M. Jody Rell Center for Public Service at the University of Hartford.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. There's a saying about aging gracefully, but new research into longevity aims to learn the science behind those who live many years and who remain healthy both physically and mentally. This certain population of people are called superagers. Certainly, Queen Elizabeth was one, passing away at age 96, making her Britain's longest reigning monarch. But she was a queen. How do regular people live that long?
What do I attribute to my long life? Good genes from my parents, I guess. No stress in the house. I've just had an easy life, and I've been lucky all the way. It all went easy. Just before Christmas, I will be 101.
That's Jules Bashkin of West Haven, a retired mattress salesman, speaking with producer Sujata Srinivasan. Jules plays the saxophone in the Survivors Swing Band. Today, Where We Live, we learned about a new study aimed towards superagers who are at least 95 years old. Coming up, we talked to one of the researchers behind the Superagers Initiative that will take saliva samples from these almost centenarians to learn more about the biology of aging. This research could help expand the promise of therapeutics to extend the number of healthy years we could live. Now, do you have relatives who are more than 90 years or even 100 years old? Think it's only good genes or other factors? We want to hear from you. 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WMPR. You can share a comment on Facebook or find us on Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us first on Zoom is Dr. Sophia Millman, Director of the Human Longevity Studies at the Institute for Aging Research at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Sophia, welcome to our show.
Good morning, Lucy. It's good to be with you and with your listeners.
It was good to hear from Jules Bashkin, who says he'll turn 101 later this year. I also wanted to play a clip from the Guinness World Records. Here it is.
Tip number one, don't die. So the first and, yes, the most obvious tip is just don't die. So let's just imagine that we could magically put aside all our medical conditions, and if you didn't die of a natural cause, you would be expected to live, on average, until the grand old age of, now wait for it, 8,938 years.
Dr. Millman, I'm wondering if you can respond to that clip. In reality, when we think about the human lifespan, what's more on average?
So the average lifespan right now is about 84 years old. Women do live a few years longer than men, but that's the average. Mm.
And when we think about even the last 2 years, life expectancy here in our country has decreased because of COVID. The CDC finds data on life expectancy dropped from 77 years in 2020 to 76 years last year. And so certainly the pandemic played a part in that, Sophia. But when we think about longevity, you know, I pose the question to our listeners, you know, how much do genes play in this fact that some can live over 90 years old and are relatively healthy?
So there's rather good evidence from our research and from many other researchers. The genes play a significant role in defining longevity, and particularly in defining exceptional longevity. So we know that the lifespan is influenced by genetics. About 20 to 40% has been explained by genetics, but that number increases the longer one lives, so that these individuals who live exceptionally long lives are more likely to have inherited longevity in their families. Mm.
Many of our listeners have heard about these so-called blue zones, that there are parts of the world where people live longer than others. Some of them include in Okinawa in Japan, Sardinia in Italy. And so I wanted you to talk about that when we think about, you know, some of the factors that researchers have found that, you know, certain areas of where people live, they tend to live a longer, healthier lives, Sophia.
So that is absolutely true. There are certain areas around the world that have greater numbers of long-living individuals compared to others. Now, I'd say the jury's still out as to why those areas are more conducive to longer living individuals, whether it is environmental or maybe the lack of certain environmental stressors, or whether it is genetic, because many individuals in those areas are relatively isolated or have been isolated for decades. And so I think we still need to understand specifically what it is, environmental, genetic, or likely combination of both that are contributing to their longevity.
Again, you can join us 888-720-9677 or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Jonathan is calling in. I understand your grandmother fits the bill as a super ager, Jonathan?
Yes, my grandmother, 98 years old, 98 years young, and she, you know, hasn't exercised a day in her life, ate, you know, an American mid-century diet of canned foods and other processed foods, and yet, you know, here she is at age 98. So, and she has some folks in her family who lived very old, so I tend to think that it has a lot to do with genetics.
So, Jonathan, you think you'll make it to the upper 90s like your grandmother?
I can only hope.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. Again, you can join us, 888-720-9677. It was interesting, Sophia, that he talked about, you know, her lifestyle, and it wasn't like she was eating, you know, only healthy food. And so it is interesting when people think about, you know, what it takes to live a long and healthy life. We think about diet, number one, but also you talked about environment.
Yeah, so that was very interesting what Jonathan has said. And we have found in one of our studies that our long-living centenarians did not practice a healthier lifestyle compared to their peers. So they were no less likely to smoke, no less likely to consume alcohol, and were not more likely to exercise, which was in some ways surprising to us, but perhaps not, because we do think genetics have a lot to do with it. That said, we think those individuals achieved longevity not because of their environment, right, but in spite of it. So despite not practicing a healthy lifestyle, they were able to live long lives, again, likely due to the protective effect of some of the genes that they possess. Mm. But we should be very careful about extrapolating that to the rest of the population, because for most of us, who likely do not have longevity genes or these protective genes that protect us from the negative effects of the environment, living a healthy lifestyle is very important and can lead to a healthier, longer life.
Well, one of the reasons we're talking with you today is you're the principal investigator of a new study called Super Agers. It's being funded through the American Federation of Aging Research. So tell us about it and what you're trying to get at the root when we think about in terms of aging well.
Because of some of the prior work that was done by us and many other investigators, and the strong evidence in favor of genetics contributing to healthy longevity, we launched the study in a collaboration with American Federation for Aging Research in order to expand the number of super agers that we can learn from. Anytime you do a genetic study, you really need large numbers of individuals in order to identify those super ager genes. And that's really the goal of the study, is to enroll about 10,000 super agers is our goal over the next couple of years, so that we can begin to unravel the genetic contribution to healthy longevity. Mm-hmm.
And I understand that you're recruiting 10,000, as you mentioned, but people age 95 or older. So what is it about that age that makes them a super ager, Sophia?
So we're really interested in extremes of age, and we thought 95 would be, you know, pretty extreme, considering the average lifespan in the United States of anywhere between 70 to 80 years. So these people are above average lifespan. And so anyone who's 95 and maintains reasonable cognitive function, whether they can understand what the study is about and can willingly participate, we would consider a super ager.
You can join us as we talk about longevity here where we live, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. With me on Zoom, Dr. Sophia Millman, who's director of the Human Longevity Studies at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine's Institute for Aging Research. So we actually have a clip from one of the participants in this Super Agers study. Her name is Elaine. Let's hear a little bit from her.
Most of the time I use public transportation. I enjoy going to the 92nd Street Y, where I socialize with people of my own age, and I play bridge and take courses in Shakespeare or whatever they're offering that's of interest to me. I do two poetry classes, both on Zoom right now. I do exercise also virtually from the Y. My days are very full every day. I have a program set up. I take care of all my own financial businesses, and I have extreme support from all of my children who call me every single night.
So it's good to hear from Elaine, who stays very busy, but she also talks about the relationships that she has. She said extreme support from all of her children who call her every night, Sophia. So tell us what else is common among super agers like Elaine.
So we do think that having social support and social engagement is important. Other than that, you know, they're quite varied. I'm not sure that there are other factors that define super agers. They do have longevity in their families, as we have spoken about earlier. So that's something that they often do share in common. But other than that, they're quite different people who come from different walks of life, have had different life experiences, have been exposed to different stressors. Some people in our study have lived through the war, World War II. So there isn't really a definition, I think, that would be common to all of them.
When we think of aging, we do think of, you know, there are age-related diseases that are more common. And can you walk us through what some of those are, Sophia? And when we think about superagers, you know, are they free of these particular diseases?
Yeah, so I think most of the listeners will recognize the diseases that we associate with advanced age, such as cancer, heart disease, strokes, diabetes, osteoporosis, high blood pressure. So these are conditions that become much more prevalent as an individual ages. What's remarkable about superagers is that many of them escape from these diseases altogether, but if they don't, they delay the onset of these diseases by as much as 20 to 30 years. And of course, an important one is Alzheimer's disease and cognitive decline that the superagers also delay by just as many decades. And so even if they don't escape from these diseases, being able to delay them by as much as two decades is really advantageous to their quality of life.
We're hearing from another listener, Brian, calling in from Southampton. Brian, tell us about some of your relatives who are super agers or getting close.
Well, I have two sort of contrasting stories to tell. One is my mother-in-law, who is alive, who is 92, who teaches water aerobics 3 days a week at her condo, whose social calendar exhausts me just hearing about it. I mean, constantly busy, lots of friends, lots of mental activity, bridge and mahjong, and follows the news, very active, alert, and connected to a very large family. The other story I have to tell is my paternal grandfather, who lived very late in life, very long. He's died now. But in during his life, I'm going to say he appeared to do everything in his power to not live long, meaning all the, you know, smoking, drinking too much, was not a very social person, no exercise that I know of, and yet lived almost to 90. Died right before he was 90 years old. So I'm looking at these two stories that seem to have nothing in common except for the outcome.
Right. Well, Brian, thank you for telling us about your relatives. It's interesting to hear that perspective, Sophia. And when I mentioned that super ager study, so this was Brian's mother-in-law, who is 92. But you're also going to be, I think, recruiting the children of super agers. So tell us more about that.
Right. So because we're really interested in factors that are inherited, we're very much focused on the children of these super agers as well, because we believe many of them have likely inherited their genes, the protective genes or the super ager genes, from their parents. And so in addition to enrolling the super agers in our study, we will also invite other children to participate, as well as the spouses of the children who may not have longevity in their family. But it is important for us to study the full spectrum of aging.
And so how long will you be recruiting these participants? And when we think about getting a wide variety, you know, will it be challenging to get diverse participants to participate in this in terms of both gender and race?
Right. So that's a very important question. We're planning to have the study go on for about 3 years. We'll be launching in late October. We're very much interested in including people from all diverse ethnic groups, racial groups, backgrounds. That is really important to us because we want the study to be representative of all groups so that we can learn as much as we can about healthy longevity. And, you know, in terms of representation of the different genders, we are going to recruit men and women, although we recognize that among the super agers, we're much more likely to recruit women than men because of the longer lifespans that women have. And in our previous studies, about 70 to 75% of our super agers were females. Mm. And we expect that we might find the same thing here.
Hmm. Except for in Sardinia, right? I believe the men were ones that lived longer than the women, but definitely interesting, again, to hear when we think about our country and life expectancy, Sophia. So listeners are probably interested in how they're going to enroll. So can you tell us where they can go?
Absolutely. So right now we have created with American Foundation for Aging Research a Super Agers community. And the website for that is www.afar.org /superagers. So listeners who are interested can go on that website and learn more about super agers and about what the study will entail. And in late October, when the study launches, there will be a link to enroll in the study. And if individuals are interested in learning more, they'll be able to do so there. And what the study will entail is a collection of basic medical information from the individual, information about their environment, their experiences in life. And then we will also mail them a saliva kit to their home so they can just swab their cheek or, you know, give us a saliva sample and mail back the kit. And we will use that saliva to extract DNA that we will then use to study super ager genes. And all the information that we collect, including the genetic information, the personal health information, will be kept secure under very tight regulatory security. Mm. So it will not be released.
Coming up, we're going to be talking about the role of wellness to help people achieve longevity. Before we head to break, though, Dr. Sophia Millman, you know, I'm wondering, when we think about super ager genes, when we think about the process of aging, you know, what can you tell us about these particular genes that help some able to, you know, live longer and remain healthy?
Sure. So some of the genes that we know about actually have been shown to extend healthy lifespan in many different organisms. So they seem to be evolutionarily conserved. The same set of genes that extend the life of worms and fruit flies and mice are very likely to also play a role in human longevity. And some of the genes that have been identified are specifically related to the growth hormone and insulin pathway. And despite what some of them, you know, in today's world may say, what research has shown is that actually having less growth hormone in older individuals promotes healthier and longer life. And we think that's because you shift energy away from growth, which becomes much less important when you're already a full-grown adult, towards maintenance and repair, which are processes that allow one to maintain good health as one ages.
You're hearing Dr. Sophia Millman, Here Where We Live, director of the Human Longevity Studies at the Einstein Institute for Aging Research in New York. She's the principal investigator of this new study we've been talking about on superagers. They're recruiting 10,000 people ages 95 and older. Now, coming up, we're going to continue talking about longevity, and we'd love to hear from you. Do you have loved ones in their 90s or even over 100? You can join us, 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WMPR. What questions do you have? You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. Loneliness can be a significant health risk to people of all ages. Dr. Laura Saunders, a psychologist from Hartford Healthcare's Institute of Living, talks about social isolation and why we need to connect in person.
Loneliness actually is a pretty significant health risk for people that struggle with social isolation. It affects their blood pressure, it affects their immune system, it affects your willingness to get up and get out, and can cause some not just emotional issues, but health problems as well.
You're not alone. Dr. Saunders explains how important it is for us to look to others and get out of our comfort zone.
I like to talk about social isolation as not just that individual's problem, but it's a community problem or it's a family problem. We need to connect with others. We can take space at times as well, but we need to step out of our comfort zone and do things to connect with other people. It's life-saving.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. What leads some of us to live well into our 90s or past 100? We're exploring the science behind longevity with my guest, Dr. Sophia Millman, director of Human Longevity Studies at Einstein College of Medicine's Institute for Aging Research. As we mentioned earlier, in the U.S., life expectancy has dropped for the second year in a row. Fueled by the pandemic, the Washington Post reports provisional data from the National Center for Health Statistics, part of the CDC, show life expectancy dropped from 77 years in 2020 to 76 years last year. Life expectancy for Native Americans dropped to 65 years old in 2021. White people had the second biggest drop, losing a full year of life expectancy, followed by Black residents. Now, helping people live longer, healthier lives goes beyond treating disease. My next guest focuses on improving wellness outcomes. UConn Health's Dr. Patrick Call from the Center on Aging co-authored an analysis of Medicare's annual wellness visits that were first instituted about 10 years ago. Call and his fellow authors found that one-size-fits-all approach needs an upgrade. Dr. Patrick Call again joins us, Medical Director for Senior Health at UConn Health. He's on Zoom with us. Welcome to the show, Patrick. Patrick, can you hear us? Oh, it looks like Patrick is having trouble hearing us. Since... Oh, are you there now? Dr. Call, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right, you're on the air now. I'm glad that we're able to hear you now. So tell us about when we think about the pandemic first and how social isolation has impacted the geriatric population in general.
Yeah, there's no question that COVID has had significant negative impacts on older adults. I was the medical director of a skilled nursing facility when the pandemic began in 2020 and witnessed firsthand how serious an illness that could be for older adults. And then we saw negative impacts from some of the restrictions that were put in place to try and protect older adults. I think initially, in the early stages of the pandemic, that was the appropriate approach. But there were negative ramifications from folks not having access to their families, to exercise, to social engagement. And so we've seen some negative impacts from that too.
Now, how did these outcomes vary by zip code?
So life expectancy, you talked earlier about life expectancy, and I think it's important to point out that pre the COVID pandemic, but life expectancy for people over 65 has been increasing quite dramatically over the last 40 or 50 years. By about 3 years every decade, life expectancy for Americans over 65 has been increasing. Now, that hasn't been a uniform increase in life expectancy, and there's no question that various socioeconomic determinants of health also have a major impact on life expectancy. And as you point out, as per zip codes, it's true that certain parts of the country where you have higher concentrations of low income folks, that can have a significant impact on their health and ultimately on their life expectancy. Mm.
You're a geriatric medicine physician, so we heard from Elaine, who's participating in this super ager study, and she talked a lot about all the activities that she was doing and that connection she still has with her children. And so I wanted you to talk more about that in relation to what you see with your patients, the fact that people who are more isolated, you know, how that impacts them long term.
So again, as was pointed out earlier, social engagement, having a sense of purpose, having a sense of mission, these factors are very important when it comes to health and longevity, as we're talking about this morning, and to function. So historically, and I think this is fair to say, and I think this is true for the Medicare wellness visit, physicians have often concentrated on what we can do to prevent our patients from dying prematurely. And clearly, that's important. So preventing heart disease, preventing cancer, preventing life-threatening infections. But I think we need to spend more time thinking about some of these psychosocial determinants of health, a person's sense of value, their worth, the social engagements that they have with others. This is something that requires much more attention from my perspective.
And so you wrote earlier in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society that this current Medicare annual wellness visit, while free, doesn't sufficiently consider, you know, this varied diversity of older adults. So tell us more about how these wellness visits usually go and what you'd like to see change as we think about, you know, how to help people age and remain healthy, not just treat disease.
So Medicare's annual wellness visit was introduced as a part of the Affordable Care Act just over 10 years ago. And it was a very positive development from my perspective, from what Medicare was doing. It's interesting, if you go back to the beginning of Medicare, Medicare was precluded from covering any forms of disease prevention or health promotion. Medicare now pays for a lot of different interventions that would be considered preventing disease or preventing illnesses. And the Medicare wellness visit, which was introduced 10 years ago, concentrates for people over 65 to spend time with their healthcare provider, to concentrate on what they can do and what they shouldn't do to promote good health. There are required elements that a healthcare provider has to cover. And as we pointed out in our paper, most of what is in there is good, but we believe that there is the need to expand the content off the wellness visit to customize it a little bit more to the patient's needs. So right now it's a one size fits all visit, whether you're 65 and healthy or 95 and maybe dealing with a lot of chronic disability and disease, it's the same set of requirements that have to be covered.
So when we think about changing how these visits are structured, that starts with the primary care physician who are also under time constraints. And so I'm wondering if you can talk more about that.
Yeah, that's a fair comment. And I think, you know, I think if there's going to be an effort to retool these visits to primarily better meet the needs of patients, I think some consideration also has to be given to how they best work for the providers that are giving this service. Many primary care providers are very, very busy taking care of the diseases and illnesses that patients have. And so carving time out of their day to concentrate on wellness, they want to do it. We very much want to do this with our patients, but it can sometimes be a challenge to fit it into a busy day. I believe that there are other members of the healthcare team who currently can participate and collect information and actually provide guidance for patients. It doesn't have to be the primary care physician that's spending all of their time on this particular intervention. But yes, I think their input is important as we might look at how we can improve these visits.
You're hearing Dr. Patrick Call, Medical Director for Senior Health at UConn Health, as we talk about aging well and the importance of wellness outcomes, not just focusing on disease, but ways to prevent and then help people have a better outcome as they age. I'm wondering, Dr. Call, if you've seen many patients who are 95 and older, and what habits or even environment are they living in that you see some commonalities, if at all?
Yes, in our practice, we have many patients in their 90s and quite a few patients in their 100s. Since I entered medical practice 35 years ago, I've seen a huge increase in the number of patients that I'm seeing who are in their 90s and in their 100s. And as was pointed out earlier, there's a great deal of variation in terms of why those patients have lived as long as they have. If I was to say that there was a common theme among them, I would say, first of all, they stopped smoking. You know, in that cohort of people who are now in their 90s, smoking when they were younger was much more common than it is now. And if you didn't stop smoking within that cohort, you probably would be very unlikely to survive into your 90s. So not smoking, exercising on a regular basis, eating a heart healthy diet, and being socially engaged with a sense of mission in your life, I would say, in very broad terms, those would be attributes that these patients tend to have.
Ailey on Facebook shared this comment. She would say, access to excellent health care certainly helps. But she also writes, Patrick, I have several ancestors who lived to beyond 90, and that was back in the 17 to early 1800s. I wonder if you can respond there.
Yeah, so we talked earlier about health, the lifespan, you know, how long a human might live. And that number hasn't changed. You know, the maximum number of years that any human might have lived, let's say we could say for argument's sake, is 115 or 110. Very few humans, even now, live to be that old. But in the past, there were, and we know this, that there were people who lived into their 90s, even in the 1700s, but they were very few. They were much rarer than is the case now. The demographics are very clear that we have so many more people living into their 80s and 90s than was the case 50, 100, or 150 years ago. And I would just point out that, you know, we're talking about longevity, which I think is very important. But my patients, when I ask them about this, they will say, you know, of course, I would like to live a long life, but I don't want to be a burden. I don't want to be disabled at the end of my life. And if that is the cost I have to pay to live to be an extreme old age, then I don't want that.
Wow. And how do you respond when they share that with you?
I understand what they're saying completely. And I think this is where, as part of our wellness approach to patients, we need to think more about what can be done to maximize function and independence. And I would say that probably the most important aspect of that recommendation from my perspective is to talk to my patients about the importance of exercise. So my patients who are older may have a variety of illnesses and diseases, and sometimes that can lead to decreased mobility, trouble getting up and moving around, even simple things like getting out of a chair or getting out of bed. So I tell my patients who are not at that level of disability now that they can prevent that from happening, but they have to take an active role. They have to concentrate on exercise, and particularly muscle strengthening exercises. We lose muscle, we lose muscle mass with increasing age, but there's a lot that you can do to preserve that muscle function and to preserve that function with regards to mobility so that you're able to get up and move around by yourself. You don't need help, and you can be this most important word for older adults. You can be independent.
Again, that's Dr. Patrick Call, Medical Director for Senior Health at UConn Health. Dr. Sophia Millman is still with us, who's a principal investigator in this Super Agers study that we learned about. Lily from Griswold has a question related to that study. Lily, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. And I would like to say I really agree with all the comments that Dr. Call just made. I work in elder care. I'm just a nursing assistant, currently a nursing student. And my question is, are they, in this super ager study, really looking into the mental health of the super agers? Because my observation with the patients that I care for, the ones in their late 90s, and even the greatest, my favorite, is 100 years old and the most independent person in the building, do they look at their mental health and how happy? My observation is, such people are very happy. They do have a close connection with their adult children. They read a lot. And overall, they do live without stress and fear. And I also observed that one such lady who is about 94 had a fall and did break a hip. It's like the fourth time in her life she's done that. And she's recovering quickly again with willpower and strength of mind. So I just wonder if this is something they're giving consideration in the study.
Thank you for that question and for sharing that with us, Lily. Sophia, can you respond?
Sure. Thank you for raising that, Lily. And there certainly have been studies in super agers that have shown that they have a more positive outlook on life. And undoubtedly, that probably plays at least some role in their ability to overcome challenges, this kind of mental resilience, right, to be able to withstand the stressors and continue to see the positive in life. So they're not only physically resilient, where they might be able to bounce back from physical illness, but probably have factors that are associated with mental resilience as well.
We also heard from Carl on Facebook, and he had another question for you, Sophia. Studies are showing that people with certain DNA markers who have COVID will see early onset of Alzheimer's, respiratory, and cardiac issues. Wants to know how that will play into your study. What can you tell him?
So I think we still have a lot to learn about the impact, the long-term impact of COVID. And there are a lot of researchers who are looking into that. In our study, we will be gathering information on whether individuals had COVID, and hopefully we'll have more answers in the future.
Again, that's Dr. Sophia Millman, Director of Human Longevity Studies at Einstein's Institute for Aging Research in New York City. Also, Dr. Patrick Call is with us, Medical Director for Senior Health at UConn Health, as we talk about longevity. Coming up after the break, we're going to continue talking with them and also talking about what biotech we'll be doing in relation to longevity and aging. I did want to share a comment from Ken in New Haven, who told us, "I moved to Florida and learned everything about nutrition. Nutrition is really important, and so is the Bible." You can join us too, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live.
Jeremy Hobson from The Middle. I'm coming to the Palace Theater in Waterbury Monday, June 3rd for a national taping of my show. Former White House climate advisor Gina McCarthy and NBC Connecticut chief meteorologist Ryan Hanrahan will be there to talk about getting the politics out of climate change. Get your tickets at ctpublic.org/the middle.
Support for Connecticut.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're talking about longevity today with my guests. Now, how will research into aging help expand the promise of therapeutics to extend the number of healthy years we could live? Dr. Sophia Millman is still with us, Director of Human Longevity Studies at Einstein's Institute for Aging Research. So I understand, Sophia, that anti-aging therapeutics are a multi-billion-dollar industry. One company is developing ways to block protein buildup that accelerates aging. There's another looking at products from stem cells to replace damaged tissues. So what do you find most promising?
I think some of the promising therapies are the ones that target pathways that have been consistently shown to impact the rate of aging. There's been decades of research now into the actual biological mechanisms that drive aging. And you know, once it was recognized that aging is a biological process, you know, just like developing high blood pressure or developing heart disease, there are biological drivers of aging, then it became clear that we could try and target those biological drivers of aging in order to extend not only the lifespan, but the health span. And I completely agree with Dr. Call that our goal really should be expanding the number of healthy years that an individual lives so that they can maintain their quality of life and their independence. And so some of these pathways that have been repeatedly shown to extend healthy lifespan in many models that have been studied include, as you've mentioned, compounds that maintain a cell's ability to clear itself of debris or buildup that occurs with aging. Also, there are certain cells that stop dividing and yet they don't die, and they're called senescent cells. And these cells often secrete inflammatory markers that may promote aging. And so there are also certain therapeutics that have been developed now. They're being actually tested in some small clinical trials that rid the body of these senescent cells in an effort to reduce this inflammatory response that may be driving aging.
Now, when we talk about therapeutics, so one day, is it possible that that we could be taking a pill that would help with some of these aging effects, like we would if we, you know, had a particular disease and needed medicine for that?
I believe so. And I think, you know, this is real science. This is not science fiction. This is not some magic hocus pocus. Because we can identify these biological drivers of aging, that's really no different, you know, as the biological drivers of heart disease, right? And we have medications to reduce the risk of heart disease. So there's no reason why we couldn't create therapeutics that would target those biological pathways that drive aging and delay the onset of aging and onset of age-related diseases. Mm.
But what are the, I guess, the barriers to that now? So the FDA, when they think about approval for drugs to treat certain diseases, you know, aging is seen as a natural process. And so can pharmaceuticals at this point really develop drugs for aging, Sophia?
So that is a very important point that you raise. The FDA currently does not have an indication to treat aging, and that has been a barrier to drug development, although many companies have pursued that anyway with anticipation that the FDA may change course. And in reality, you know, by targeting aging, by delaying aging, you have the ability to delay multiple diseases simultaneously, because we feel that aging is a contributor, and we have evidence for that as well, to many diseases, including heart disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's disease, dementias. And so by actually targeting the aging process itself, you can have an impact on many of these diseases simultaneously.
Mm. When we think about how drugs will be developed in the future, or they're working on it now, you know, how they'll be priced, right? You know, who will be able to have access to this particular medicine, you know, as we see how pharmaceuticals price certain medications now?
Yeah, that certainly will be important. And we want to ensure that everyone has equal access to these medications. And the reality is it will be advantageous for our society to provide access to these medications, because A, it will improve the quality of life and independence of older adults, and then they can continue contributing to society for many more years. So that will be an advantage to our society, to our economy. Additionally, there will be cost savings to our healthcare system, because if people will not be getting diseases, or they will be getting them much later in life, and hopefully deal with those chronic conditions for a shorter period than they would have otherwise, that would be a savings to the healthcare system. Now, there is a possibility of using medications that are inexpensive, are currently generic, for extension of healthy lifespan. And there is a study that is underway called Targeting Aging with Metformin Study, which is co-sponsored by the American Federation for Aging Research, that aims to use metformin, which is an inexpensive drug that is currently FDA approved to treat diabetes, but that has been shown to have multiple beneficial effects beyond treating diabetes. It has been shown to prevent diabetes. In some studies, it has been shown to prevent cardiovascular disease, has also been suggested to reduce the risk of cancer and possibly even cognitive decline. And so there's very active work now being done to use that medication to study to delay aging. And there is an ongoing study with metformin to actually see if it can delay frailty. Mm.
Dr. Patrick Call is still with us from UConn Health. I'd love to get your perspective. We just have a couple of minutes, but when we think about longevity, biotechnology, you know, what are your thoughts, Dr. Call?
Yeah, I think it's a very exciting area of research. And as has been pointed out, so many diseases become so much more common with increasing age. And so looking at the aging process and how we can manipulate the expression of whatever those determinants are related to age definitely has the potential to have a positive impact on the outcome and incidence of age-associated diseases. I would just add, you know, that I think this research, again, is very important, but under the current construct of disease prevention and health promotion, we've talked about these Medicare wellness visits. And so I would encourage your listeners, Lucy, who have Medicare, to reach out to their primary care doctors. If you've not had a wellness visit, you're entitled to one. It's a no-cost visit. There's no copay. There's no deductible. And I would encourage you to make those appointments, get out there, talk to your healthcare providers, because there's a lot that you can do now, short of what the research might tell us works in the future, there's a lot that you can do now to maintain your health and wellness into your advanced old age.
Again, that's Dr. Patrick Call, Medical Director for Senior Health at UConn Health. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Also with us today on Zoom, Dr. Sophia Millman, Director of Human Longevity Studies at Einstein's Institute for Aging Research. We'll be sure to check in with you to learn more about super agers as that study launches. Thank you for your time today, Sophia.
Thank you, Lucy. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today's show produced by Sujatha Srinivasan. Tess Terrible was on the phones today. Our technical director is Kat Pastor. We'll be back tomorrow.